Thanks a lot for the invitation. Very pleased to be here in these nice rooms, which I hear you're going to abandon soon.
Yep.
So I'm very pleased that I had the chance to be here before you do. So this is a paper that I've written with Vasiliki Tsagroni, who is a lecturer at Leiden University. Unfortunately, this is not here, but what I will be saying is our common work. And it's coming out very soon at JCMS. So I thought, because we haven't presented it very much, I thought it's a good opportunity to actually talk about it and also talk to you about some ideas that we have about how this could be developed further. So this is part of a greater project that was funded by Aristia, which was a framework program, one of the EU framework programs for research in Greece, and was about the collective action of indignant citizens, the indignados, similar to Spain, causes, content, agency, and implications for policymakers. And we were asked to work on the policymakers, but to stay in the discussion of the parliamentarians and the parliament and what happened outside the parliament, inside the parliament, around this area. So what we decided to do was to try to find out what happened with the discourse, the political discourse during the crisis. So had it changed, or how does a crisis affect the political discourse? And to more specifically, to see whether politicians are shifting the blame and towards whom. Our assumption was that the politicians would be shifting the blame towards the EU, but there was no much evidence, so we thought we should go and find out if this is what is happening, because this was what was happening at Syntagma Square, so we wanted to know what was happening in the parliament. And exactly our theoretical framework developed around these ideas of blame shifting, exogenization of the crisis. There is a literature there that had not been applied yet to the current crisis. It was a more general literature about what politicians are doing when they face a crisis. And of course, at the beginning, we were lured with the idea of touching on the populism literature. This proved to be very difficult because populism is very difficult to define. So although a lot of the things that we're talking about are about what we would call populism in everyday language, it was very difficult to translate them into the theoretical debate and use this literature. So we've read it, we participated in workshops, but at the end we're not really contributing to this literature. But I will come back to this. The method, and I should already apologize, because the method is the making of my co-author, so I'm trying to explain it, but she knows it much better. So it's computer-assisted content analysis, but also reading the texts themselves, so both reading and computer-assisted content analysis of the Parliament's bailout debates in the three, just before the three memoranda. So all three of them. So what happened in the Parliament debates just before the voting of each of the memoranda. So these are the three issues that I will be talking about, and also what are the findings and what we think is interesting that we could do with this research later on. So a little bit as an introduction. So why did we think that this discussion is interesting? We were wondering whether the way the Parliament responds to the crisis, at least I was wondering, this was my main reason for getting into this, affects the way policies are implemented. So the thinking was that if the debates in the Parliament and the discussions in the Parliament are about blaming other actors and are not about the actual problems and how we solve them, probably that would affect the ownership of the programs and the implementation. We managed to work on the first bit, so what happens with blame and the Parliament and the discourse of the Parliament. How it affects policy would probably be a next step. It was not possible to do that in one paper. The other reason why I thought this was an interesting project was that these changes in the political and parliamentarian discourse are everywhere. It's something that we see in many, many different countries, here in Britain, in the States, and this discussion about populism and how political and parliamentarian discourse is changing is not something that we only saw in Greece, but Greece was a very good example since this was happening for quite a long period and for because of a crisis. So what the argument is in this paper, and I will develop it a bit later, go into more detail in the next slides, is first of all that blame shifting increases during crisis, and I will explain why in a minute, but that exogenization of the crisis, meaning that trying to say that we are not responsible for the causes or the solutions, is complex because it involves, at least in our case, it involves a domestic mediator between the external enemy, which is the EU or the globalization or the IMF, Troika, and the crisis. And in the case that we discussed, this is the old establishment, what is called the old establishment. And this is something that we see also in other cases, and we see quite a lot in different places in Europe, in reality. We haven't done the same research, but we have heard this idea that the old establishment is to be blamed for many different things. So what we find is that the politicians, the parliamentarians, are not blaming directly the EU, but they are indirectly blaming the EU by first focusing on the old establishment and how they have collaborated with this external enemy. We call that historical blame shifting because normally the way they talk about it goes back in the past, and the blame is about what this old establishment parties did wrong and how they brought the country in the situation that it is now, and trying to link this with the current situation. And then three other things are part of our argument and of our findings at the same time. First of all, that when a party comes to government, this blame shifting actually declines. And we see that in all the different periods, and I will show you some graphs in a minute. There is a common strategy we find in the discourse of the parliamentarians to evade from the problem when they are actually in government or when they are when they have to deliver. So they talk much more directly about who is to be blamed or what the crisis is about when they are in opposition. But then they start talking more about technicalities or other issues. And then we argue that party leaders use a much more polemic discourse than the MPs. So a lot of the times the rest of the MPs are trying to keep the voices down, but the party leaders are really very outspoken and they are blaming various actors quite a lot. So now to go back to the theory. Populism. So this didn't go very well, as I said. Because populism is defined in completely different ways in the literature. So what we wanted to, we were assuming that what blame shifting does is that probably there are some lies or trying to evade the focus. So we found a lot of characteristics of what is defined as populism in the literature, but it was very difficult to say that what is happening is populist. So we kept this knowledge to move to the next part of the literature. It's about blame shifting and exogenization. This is a literature that has been developed for a while and looked at what politicians do when there is a crisis. And what they have been, Boyin is one of the people working on it, and what they have been arguing is that when there is a crisis, what politicians really care about Okay, I'll wait because these are very good colleagues from Queen Mary, which is quite far away in the east of London. Thank you for being here. So the literature says that when there is a crisis, what politicians do is that the first thing that they're interested in is not to find a solution, but shift the blame. So because they understand that what is more important for them is to survive and not to find a solution. Most of the research on blame shifting and the way the crisis is exogenized has been focusing either on how politicians perceive this discourse, so by looking at opinion polls, or the way the media is discussing this. So there hasn't been much research on the way elites actually do the shifting of the blame, which we found weird in reality, because we would think that all the literature would be on political elites, but no. So we thought that this is a very good opportunity to focus on political elites and parliamentarians to understand what is happening internally. And I think by focusing on the elite level, we managed to discover these issues about historical blame shifting that we cannot see if we just look at the opinion poll surveys or what the media are saying. And then the third part of the literature that we have found very interesting and we linked to our argument is Myers' discussion about representative versus responsible government. So Myers' argument is that political parties want to be representative of what the people want. They want to represent the people, and this is what a lot of the protest parties are doing. This is what Syriza was doing. They were trying to represent what was happening in the square. But Mark continues to say that what is happening when these parties come to government is that they are forced to act responsible because they need to actually implement something, perform. So we link that to the discussion of blame shifting, and we're trying to see if actually their discourse changes when in government from what was happening when in opposition, and actually we do find a big change. So this is more or less the theoretical framework. And we end up with two main hypotheses. The first one is that exogenization discourse of causes and responsibility, so we're interested in how they shift the blame both for the causes of the crisis and the causes and solutions of the crisis, is prominent during the crisis, during crisis periods. And then the second one is that exogenization discourse levels are higher for parties in opposition than for governing parties, following Myers' argument, and that there's a mechanism when in government which is evasion of the focus of the real problem. So this is how they achieve to change their discourse when in government, basically. So the case study, Greece, in the Eurozone crisis. I don't need to say much about the crisis, we know it. 2008 financial crisis brings out the chronic aggravating problems and the necessity for policy decisions. We end up with the three bailout programs, which are our units of analysis. And we say that there are three main changes in the political system. First of all, traditional parties are losing ground. Secondly, we have more coalition governments. Well, we have coalition governments, which is not something that we used to have. But then thirdly, and very importantly, there is a shift of the political debate. There are more cleavages now. There is more discussion. The political discourse changes. We're talking about pro-memorandum and against memorandums. Later, we have this discussion about pro-euro and against euro, pro-drachma or not. So the political debate becomes much more contentious, and this needs to be analyzed further. So these are all reasons why we think this is a good case to analyze this type of changes. And now my favorite bit, the methodology. So what happened here? And I'll drink some water. Here is where Vasiliki did her magic and worked so hard to bring all the data together. So, well, first of all, we've read all the debates to be sure that what the computer will do will actually reflect what we are reading. And she used the Hamlet 2 in order to analyze all these texts. The main actors that we were looking to see if they are blamed was the establishment and the EU, but also the other international actors, IMF, Troika. We used various words to do this research. The unit of analysis, as I said, was just the parliamentary debates. At some point, we tried to do a comparison with Cyprus, but this became too complicated, and we left it. And then we also tried to distinguish between the MPs and the leadership, their discourse, the different discourses. And of course, all this was done in Greek. So we were looking for the populist appeal. We were looking to find if they are talking about the people, the conflict versus consensus debates, so the pro-consensus versus anti-establishment debates we could find, and the pro-EU internationalists versus the anti-EU international discourses, and also the policy reforms. So if the parliamentarians were talking pro-memorandum or anti-memorandum. So how exactly she did it? You can ask me. I will email her and I will let you know. But it was both the computer and our reading. So what happened with hypothesis one? We did find quite a lot of exogenization discourse of both causes and responsibility over solutions during the crisis, and I will show you some graphs in a minute. The exogenization pointed clearly to the old establishment. There was a lot of this historic and blame shifting. This was the only exception to that was the Papandreou government in 2010 that was taking the blame itself. So they were saying that we are to be blamed. Because this was also their discourse before the elections. So they were saying that we are coming as a new version of the PASOK, and we're going to really change what was happening. So the crisis found them with this discourse, and they kept it. All the other parties were trying to blame the previous, the old establishment.
Can I just so Samaras 2012?
He was blaming the old establishment.
Right.
Themselves in the past.
Right. In the third person.
I will show you the the graphs in a minute. So the blame sheet was from internal towards the external factors. So first, the old establishment and the failures of the Greek system were to be blamed. I'm not saying that there were no failures, yeah? But they were starting from that, and this was then directing to blaming the EU for working with this system, for accepting the statistics for so many years, for knowing what Greece is about but ignoring it, and this type of arguments. And there was always, and this is a populist element that we didn't manage to bring in very well, but we've written about it, it's this appeal to the people who were the only blameless. Nobody ever blamed the people. The people were the only blameless in this situation. And of course we found these differences between leadership and the MPs. Let me show you some of this. So I don't know if you can see. This is the people. The different colors are the different parties. This is 2010. And who they blame. For whom they're talking. They're talking about the people, but in a positive way. They're trying to say if it is the memorandum, if they are pro-memorandum, or if they are, pro-memorandum is the second one, or if they are anti-memorandum, it's the fourth one, pro-consensual, and anti-establishment, pro-EU, anti-EU. So we see the different parties and how they change.
Syriza is in grey, and if we look on the far left, just yes. sorry to interrupt, but the reference is to, quote, the people.
Mm-hmm.
Syriza is the lowest.
Yes. To just say that the people are not to be blamed. None of them blames the people, yeah? So they are all talking about the people as the blameless, as the only ones that...
but Syriza kind of, are...
Are not referring to the people so much. Yeah. Yes, yes. So this picture changes a bit in 2012, yeah? So they all speak more about the people the different... so I'll just go back and forward to show. And then again in 2015, which the landscape, of course, is completely different here. Because here we have new parties, we have Golden Dawn, we have the Topotami, and I will talk about what happens with these two parties and why they're so high up in the anti-establishment discussion. In 2015. And this is what's happening with the parties. This is PASOK, and the first graph is about the PASOK's MPs in 2010-15, and how they talk about the people, if they talk about pro-memorandum, anti-memorandum, etc. And here is the leadership. So we see that the leadership is always much more liberated when they actually talk about anything. We have all the periods in the same graph here. So the darker color is 2010, the lighter is 2012, and the even lighter is 2015. And the same graph we have for New Democracy. So here we can see the Samara government, if you want. So the Samaras government that we were talking about before, it's the blue here, and the Syriza. Syriza, I don't know why we didn't find shades of red, so it's in all sorts of colors. So we have, so Syriza in 2010 is a dark blue, 2012 is the light blue, and then we have the green for 2015. And I will continue a little bit with what we find in Hypothesis 2, and we'll come back to these graphs if you want. So the graph two was the Hypothesis 2 was about the shift in the behavior of the opposition parties, and we see quite a lot of that for all the parties, but especially for Syriza and Anel in 2015, where their discourse really becomes much softer. And the parties that are actually coming with the strongest discourse, anti-establishment discourse, blame-shifting discourse, is Golden Dawn and Topotami. And our assumption is that this is happening, we know that for Syriza this is happening because they are in government. So this confirms the Meyer argument about responsive versus responsible government. But for Golden Dawn and Potami, we assume that this is because they are just coming in the scene for the first time and they want to show that they are really polemic. And I will show you this graph that shows exactly that. So this is the yellow is Syriza in 2015 and how it becomes pro-memorandum. And so obviously after the referendum this is happening, yeah? So this is analyzing the discussions in the parliament just before voting the third memorandum. So they're becoming pro-memorandum and much less anti-establishment. The same for Anel. And here is the second graph. The black one is Golden Dawn and the purple is Potami. And they are completely anti-establishment, memorandum, but at the same time pro-EU and international, pro-international. So this is really, I think, an interesting shift. And then there is this sense of evasion that I cannot show with graphs, but this is more by analyzing the text. So all the pre-election rhetoric changes when in government, and the discussion becomes much more about what are the rules of the game and how can we persuade the EU, or should we actually vote in fast track processes or not? So it's not about what is in the memoranda, it becomes much more about the technicalities of the debate, about possible electoral losses. So they're already talking before voting the memoranda. They spend a lot of the time in Parliament openly talking about what this would mean for electoral losses, and even about future blame attributions. So what will happen if we don't actually perform? But not so much about what should be done. I'll show you that. So just to summarize, and I don't know, maybe I have more time, but we can discuss also. It doesn't matter. Historical blame shifting is what we see. So mistakes of the past are blamed for today's failures, and we see that in every government all the time. So they very rarely speak about their own responsibilities, but much more about what they inherited. The other interesting thing is that blame shift is universal, so it's not like only a couple of parties are doing it. We find this in all the parties. I think this is something that we have also read in the populist literature, that normally when you have populism in one party, this is then spreading into the whole system. So the whole system becomes, the discourse of the whole system becomes more populist. So the same thing we find for blame shifting and exogenization of the crisis. When one party starts, all the rest are following the same type of discourse. And the blaming is mainly directing to the center, to the old establishment, which is the parties of the center, which means that the two other sides are becoming much more powerful. We find a lot of strong blame-shifting discourse at the leadership level for all leaders. Samaras, Tsipras and Kamenos are our best cases. They have really gone up the peak of blaming in comparison to Papandreou, who does it much less. But in reality, you can't say much about political affiliation. You know, it is also a matter of personality, I think, because we see it in all the spectrum of the political parties, from the left to the right. This shift, this blame shift, being stronger at the leadership level. I already talked about blame shifting decreasing when parties are in governing coalitions. Because of the responsibility effect, Syriza in 2015, I think, is one of our best cases, and the evasion of the focus of the strategy. So our idea for that is where to go next. I think it's, first of all, to try to explain some of it a bit better, you know, because we can't explain everything with the theoretical framework that we now have. For example, explain and compare what is happening in other cases, such as the Cypriot case that we started analyzing the blame shifting there. The problem there was that we only have one memorandum, so it would be a little bit, we would have to, you don't have the same time, so there are some methodological issues. And then I think that the next step that I'm really interested in, and we are talking about it, about that a little bit in our analysis, is how this has an impact upon policies in reality. So if this is a parliamentarian discourse, and it's all about blame shifting, with all these different variations that we see, what does this mean for actually implementing policies and actually realizing what they're voting and what they are actually committing to? So that would be the next step, but we have to think how exactly we will design this research in order to be meaningful. So any ideas are welcome. And I don't think, well, these are some graphs that I don't think you can see, so you will see them in the paper, I think, which are like the total image of what happened. But I don't think we can see them, and that's why we did the colored ones before. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Stella, very much indeed. it seems to confirm and give us much more empirical justification for some of the assumptions about blame shifting during the crisis period. Perhaps I could just start off with a couple of points myself, and then we'll open it up to everyone. I wasn't quite sure why your evidence falls short of satisfying the populist or populism hypothesis, because you emphasize that you have two critical dimensions here. There's a historic blame shift against the old establishment. Mm-hmm. When Andreas Papandreou talked about the establishment, I think everyone understood that this qualified as populism. And secondly, you also have this dimension that it's them, not us. It's the blame shifting outside of Greece, the EU, the international sphere. So how does your evidence not satisfy the populism hypothesis?
Okay. Well, the problem is that literature on populism has two strands in reality that they don't speak to each other at all. And actually I saw that in action when I went to the ACPR session on populism in Pisa, that by mistake some of the people from the other camp were in the room and they were completely... I have never seen that in any other field in political science so much as in populism.
What are the two
camps? So the one camp is the MOVE Laclau camp, which sees populism as a very positive development, which means populism for them means coming closer to the people and expressing the people. So it's all about being responsive, and it's very, very positive. And then it's Takis Papas and other people. I'm talking about Takis because he's working on Greece, so maybe people are familiar with his work, that are talking about populism in its negative connotation, which is us against the others, and the way that it's much closer to the way the media are using the word populism in a negative connotation. But it's impossible to enter the debate without having people just rejecting your article or your argument just because of your definition and the way you define it. So there is so much energy lost in trying to explain to them why you choose to discuss this issue in these terms, that at the end it was counterproductive. So it's a problem of academia. It's not a problem of the word populism. It's an academic problem that we encounter sometimes with concepts that are overstretched or...
But I assume that on the kind of Laclau Staphylococcus sort of aspect of populism, not the Laclau, on the Takis Papas line of populism,
we would be...
being negative, you seem to have quite a lot of evidence which is consistent with their notion of populism.
Yes, yes. And I think we can actually write about something shorter, which is not going to an academic journal. But for a journal, we would have to spend so much time trying to clear up this mess of populism that we ended up saying that it's not worth it, because what we want to see is really how the blame is shifting, where does it go, and what does it mean. So we don't really need... It was a strategic decision.
Sorry to
be so blunt.
I'm going to... please indulge me. I've got to ask the next one more question, for which I apologize. Your research takes us to 2015, which is great, but of course it would be tremendously interesting to bring it to 2019. So you have a party in power that some regard as having come to government with a populist campaign. Do you think that's... is your impression that the evidence since 2015 would be consistent with your conclusions here?
Yes. We don't have a memorandum, of course, now to explore, thanks God. We don't have any more. So... we don't have a similar debate to analyze, because we analyze the discourse, the parliamentary discourse, just before the voting of the memoranda. So it's very difficult methodologically to compare what's happening now without a memorandum, but we could maybe explore what is happening when we have a discussion around what the lenders are telling us post-memorandum.
Yes.
But yeah, I think the Syriza's discourse more or less stays the same now. It's how we saw it in 2015. Mm. It's much more, not pro-memorandum, but pro-reform. And when they're not so polemic as they were when they came to power, which was just a little bit earlier.
Okay, many thanks. You've touched on many different aspects of the crisis and the impact of domestic politics. Let me open it up. Angela.
Thank you, sir. It was very interesting. My comment has to do with future avenues of research, mm-hmm. and especially your second strand of potential research, you know, how to kind of mm-hmm. tie this with policy implementation, right? I mean, first of all, I think you already have something that you can use as a measurement of program ownership, right? Mm-hmm. So the more exogenization of blame you have, the less program ownership you have, and then you can expand your criteria of search in the software and say whether they use the word of sacrifice, so, you know, we need to make sacrifices, we don't really like the program, but we have to do it anyway. That's also a measure of small ownership problem. And then what you can do is actually tie this policy implementation, right? Mm-hmm. And do maybe an in-case comparison between two governments that have different levels of program ownership measured according to this index, or even go across cases and do, I don't know, Greece and Portugal. We have some mm-hmm. friends in Portugal that can help you with the Portuguese parliament there. Or you could even do Ireland.
Yeah.
You know, and look, you know, how policy implementation of the program varies according mm-hmm. to the program ownership.
Yeah, I think that's what we tried to do with Cyprus, mm-hmm. because we assumed that the discourse, and we knew by reading what happened in the parliament, was much more consensual and much less blame shifting. Of course, there was some, but there wasn't so much. So I think the comparative element would show quite a bit for this type of research, but it could also be extended to what this means for the ownership and the implementation, because at least in Cyprus we saw that the implementation was much easier. But the same for Ireland and Portugal. The problem is again the methodology. So we have to make a case about, to either choose a memorandum and just compare one of the Greek memoranda with the other, or explain why this is the case. I mean, this is a problem now with all comparative work that we are doing for the crisis. So for a book that we are now writing with some Portuguese colleagues, we are co-authoring in Greece, is the case that has three memoranda. How do we compare? How do we compare the reforms? How do we compare the reversals of the reforms? So once more, Greece is a little bit of a unique case, which spans, it's a much longer period and different programs to analyze. But I think there are ways, and the methodology shouldn't stop us from researching interesting questions. So yeah, thanks for the suggestion.
Other comments, questions? Please.
It's quite easy to blame, but did you find any justification for either group of people when they were doing this blame shifting with any kind of evidence or just when they were doing
so the how they were
doing the blaming, so
was it justified
with evidence, some kind of evidence?
Not very nicely, yeah. I mean, it's not like real evidence. What the most of the discourse was trying to be provocative, so it was not about really finding evidence. It was just saying you brought us where you did because of being incompetent for so many years. You were allies of the Germans. The Germans are called Nazis. The referendum is called, what happened after the referendum is called the coup. The language is, it's not about justifying with real evidence most of the times, but with just making the discourse very polemic and offensive and this type of discussion. So no real evidence.
And also in parallel, I'm sure.
Sorry?
In parallel, at the same time, you would have lots of Greek institutions will be producing quite a lot of research.
Yeah.
In what's happening to their economy. I mean, was that taken into account or dismissed?
I don't think we found much of the... I mean, these are the discourses just before the voting of the memoranda. So we shouldn't forget that these particular days were very tense all three times because we were always at the cliff just before voting from the memorandum. So none of the memoranda was voted in a calm period or in any kind of normality. So they were not... actually referring to any type of this kind of evidence. I'm not saying that there was no... Of course they had, they could say that there has been corruption in the past, and of course there is evidence for that, but there was no time to really link it. It was more like a dramatic appeal and a much more tense moment. Maybe we choose different parliamentary discussions, we'll find more of what you are suggesting, but not just before the voting of the memoranda.
Please. So does this shift in discourse, let's say, have a direct effect on voter behaviours? Is it successful in, let's say, an anti-EU international kind of idea? Does this actually correlate to a gaining in voters?
Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't done this research, yeah? But I think... as we've seen from the election results, it did make sense for the parties to shift the blame. So Papandreou didn't win much by saying that PASOK is to be blamed. Actually, PASOK is one of the parties that suffered the most. I'm not saying that this happened because of Papandreou's discourse, but he didn't really win anything from that. So... And I we find also that in the literature on populism, that the parties... have to all become populist in order to lure the voters. So why not here? But we haven't really correlated these findings with research on what how the voters are reacting. There was a paper earlier on by Vasilopoulou and others in JCMS doing this thing, and they were looking at what people, how people were reacting, and they were finding very similar things to us. And in a way, we are doing the other side, the political elite side.
Yeah, it is a very interesting point because if you look at the European Union's Eurobarometer public surveys, then during this period, Greece has the biggest fall ever anywhere in terms of positive attitudes towards EU membership. So your point as to whether this populism has an effect on electoral opinion, then clearly there is a graph line that you could have which would be highly consistent with the domestic populist attacks.
But just to say maybe to that what is interesting is that although this is happening, we don't find so much discussion of the EU in the parliamentarian discourse. So it's all about the domestic level. So that most of the time they're discussing how the domestic actors are to be blamed, but they don't use the word EU so often. They just make the connection indirectly. So I think that for us was the biggest surprise. And at the beginning, we couldn't really find a way to understand what we were finding because we could see all this Euroscepticism. But the discourse was not about Europe. The discourse was about the old establishment. And then when we started reading, we saw that they were relating the old establishment with the EU by saying that they were allies of the EU, and this is what happened. So it was a bit indirect.
I suppose just to go back to the previous point in terms of the comparisons, there'd be an interesting aspect in terms of the... to put it crudely, the populism shown by EU partners towards Greece. If we think in terms of the work of people like Kalypso Nikalidis and Dimitris Papadimitriou and Sotiris Sartoulidis, then the external narrative, so when the German media talks about Greece, when foreign media systems and politicians talk about Greece, then it's a much more negative stereotype than when any talks about Portugal, Ireland, or Cyprus.
Yeah.
So there's this provocation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and this literature we used their findings. Yes, what I was saying is that most of the literature on blame shifting was looking at the media and the opinion polls, and exactly they saw this provocation and how this reflects to the media discourse in Greece. Mm. But yeah, we didn't go into the media; we stayed here.
Katerina.
Two-part question, which partly relates to this one. So you mentioned earlier that there is a trend where one becomes populist first, and then others sort of copy them, and then everybody is a populist in the end. Is it something that your data shows, or is it something that we just know from the literature? I wasn't clear on this. And the second part is, if this does happen in Greece here, is this maybe a result of someone being a populist abroad first, and then we sort of copy as Greece?
The second part, can you...
I don't know, maybe...
Relate to what Kevin was saying, that because the media abroad are talking about Greece...
So partly that, but also political debates related to this issue, either in the EU or in other countries that have some connections here with Greece, they are becoming populist, so then we are also becoming populist.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So our evidence doesn't talk about populism because, as I said, we avoided using the word populism. But we are actually talking about all the characteristics of populism. So in reality, yes, we do. But the literature also says that populism spreads from one party to the other. So we are basically confirming what the literature says about populism spreading, but we do it more by focusing more on the blame-shifting exogenization characteristics of populism, not attributing any mistakes to the people. So it's like we broke down the characteristics of populism and tried to find what is happening with each of them without then bringing them back together and saying that it's about populism. And the second aspect, the second part of your question, I think it's again it's interesting, and again in the literature on populism there is a discussion about how populism spreads also across borders. We didn't do any work to see how maybe what the media was saying influenced the parliamentarians. I don't even know how we would manage to see. I don't know how we would be able to analyze how what they were listening, the perceptions from what was happening abroad, would affect the way they were talking about it in government.
You could have some kind of timeline, couldn't you? So when Silk magazine says, what a good idea to sell the Acropolis.
I think some...
you could see,
there are some people that did that. There are some people in the University of Crete that did some work on that. Kanellopoulos and some others, they did some work, but they were focusing mainly on the media. So they were trying to see media and public opinion. They didn't see media and parliamentarians, but maybe we could do something to see media and parliamentarians. Why not? Yeah, it's an interesting... You both raised that, so I should write that we should do another research on that.
Other comments or questions? Can I just ask you, what did you find the most significant surprise in the results? In the sense that quite a lot seems to confirm.
I think it's what I was mentioning before, that there was no direct accusation of Europe. We thought we would find this, because in the media it was all about the Troika, the Germans, the IMF, but in the parliamentarian discussions there was very little of that. So what they were doing was taking advantage of this discussion to make sure that they profit politically and domestically and win the next elections. So, and I think they avoided talking like that because they knew that they had to talk with Europe at the end of the day. So it's another thing to have the media talking like that, and it's another thing to have the parliamentarians. So I was really expecting to find this in the discourse, and we didn't. So that was, I think, the biggest surprise, and this is how we ended up developing this idea of historical blame shifting rather than exogenization of the crisis towards international institutions or something like that. Yeah.
Other points? Yanni?
Some blame must be more or less valid than other blame.
Mm-hmm.
this discussion has been without reference to the quality of the argument in favor of blaming this or that. Is there any way we can bring that in?
I think that's the weakness of our research, because what we're doing is we are analyzing the discourse, and we're not really, in this paper at least, we're not really analyzing what was there before. And as we know from other research that a lot of us have done, of course there was a lot that they could blame to the old establishment. So there was something that they could, they could hang on and develop this discourse. And interestingly, even the parties themselves, even the old establishment parties themselves, like New Democracy, are blaming themselves, or PASOK are blaming is blaming itself. Well, the New Democracy is trying to blame PASOK. PASOK is the only party that is blaming itself. So there was a lot of truth, of course, back there about corruption, about lack of institutional development, policies that they were not implemented, economic, macroeconomic data that was, you know, that we hadn't managed to reach. So there was a lot there. But in this paper, at least, we don't look so much at that, but more at the discourse during the parliamentarian discussions. But yeah, you're right.
Comments or questions?
Agelos,
please.
I have another interesting variation to actually look at how the discourse and the blame shifting shifts across venues in domestic political spectrum. Right?
Across?
Across venues in domestic politics. So, for example, in the parliament, you may actually not have politicians blame Europe or the EU very much, but we do
in
know from public discourse in Greece, for example, that Syriza did make a division between the Europeans and the IMF, and they made this argument that we don't really want the IMF in the process anymore. So maybe you could actually also see how they play essentially actors against each other, or you know, how they actually change the discourse, or whether they talk to a newspaper, or whether they talk to the parliament, where they know that the Europeans and the IMF are going to actually look at the streets.
Yes, I think that's certainly very interesting, and previous research on the media had shown exactly how they were really, the blame was directed to the EU, especially in the media. And that's why it was also surprising not to find this in the parliament. But if you do this comparison, as you suggest, maybe we can even say something about institutions and different venues and why they don't do it in the parliament. I mean, we always have a very low esteem about the parliament in Greece. We don't think much of it. But at the end, they didn't use the same discourse that they used in the media. Why is that? You know, and I think this kind of comparison, but also some more qualitative research would be necessary there to be able to understand why the same person talks differently in a newspaper, and then it's more careful, he or she is more careful when he or she talks in the parliament. Do they really respect the institution, or is there something else there? Yeah, so, yeah, interesting.
So, there's also something about oppositions blame governments. The government, when it was PASOK, went in for this self-blame. Subsequent governments, that is, as we extend the crisis, I wasn't quite sure what they were, who they were mostly blaming. So after PASOK, when parties come into power, who are the biggest targets for governments to blame?
The old establishment.
So
no
so
matter...
New Democracy and then...
but New Democracy by focusing on the PASOK years.
I see, yes.
Because they were saying that just before the crisis, we had the PASOK government. The Karamanlis government was not to be blamed for New Democracy, but it was the Papandreou government that hid the truth, that at the end revealed the statistics. They blamed just Papandreou.
Okay.
They didn't. And then the old PASOK, Andreas Papandreou, and all the attitudes back there. For Syriza, of course, and for the other parties, it was much easier to blame the old establishment.
Okay. Please.
Yes, I was really interested in the one you had on parties throughout the years. Shades of grey and blue or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether that was actually how much was taken into consideration, if this was based only on the crisis discourse instead of being the frequent legislative elections during that period, and also if that was translated into how that changed, and then was it a political system reason, not a crisis, like entrance of new parties, then you have cultural differences, then you have, of course, the people who were not, they're not the blamers, and all this. Was this attributed to that as such, or was it just a change because of the crisis discourse? Because that didn't really change. We had a lot of radical left parties in government during the crisis, which were voted on a populist agenda to change against this anti-establishment and blah, 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 whatever the case. And they all were in, they all voted in Morambis. And in that case, was it because of their need to actually get their votes? Or was it because of, no, we have to change our discourse on the crisis because this is what we were voted upon, or whatever the case? Because it just seems that we're talking about a blame game, but is it a blame game just to win votes, or is it a blame game just because the crisis conditions changed each time?
Okay, yes. So it's a blame game both for the causes and for the solutions. Okay, so I tried to say that in the beginning, meaning that there are different games there for the cause, and they concentrate mainly on the causes, which is why did we end up with this crisis? So most of the discussion, and I don't know if I'm answering you, you correct me if I'm not. So most of the discussion is about how we came to this crisis, rather than whether the solution, the memoranda, is a good one or not. And I think they do that because they are trying to win the elections. Of course, the whole discourse is different during the crisis because even the wording, the categories are different. When we, before the crisis or after the crisis, we won't have a discussion of pro-memoranda or pro or against memoranda, or hopefully pro-euro, against
but you
euro.
You did have euroscepticism because it's been brewing since a lot of time. You would have the pro-EU, against the EU, or pro-Brexit.
Without the crisis?
Yes, before the crisis. In any case, there are scepticism, whatever the case. So if you don't have that before, the comparison before. Okay, I'm not saying the after, because of technical difficulties, but then at least the before in 2008 or whatever, then to have that, which was the even the initial knowledge of, oh, there's going to be a crisis, or something's going wrong in the States or in the UK, then that affecting and filtering in the country, because, I mean, I'm guessing the corruption scams or whatever must have been prominent in the country for many years before that, even though the people might not have taken the blame.
But there was not much before the crisis. There was not much discussion for about. I mean, there was no real Euroscepticism or discussion against the EU. It all not in, like in other European Union countries. I think in Greece, really, the crisis brought this out. And I think if we try to do the same research in another voting situation just before the crisis, and we try to find this EU, if it used to be blamed for something, I don't think we would find much. Maybe we need to do it, but to be sure. But our starting point was to see how the discourse changed during the crisis by looking at the media discussions and what others have found in the research about how discourse changed during the crisis. And then we took this and tried to find the words that were the most commonly used to do this research and see if the same words appear in the parliamentary discourse. So this is how we approached it. So if we take the same words and put them before the crisis, I don't think we'll find so much, if I understand what you're saying correctly. Yeah.
If no one has a question,
please.
It's just in the case of, let's say we're still taking the 2010-2015 period, okay, but we don't take it in terms of voting or memorandums, we take it in terms of legislative elections.
Okay.
So the unit of analysis is the election itself instead of the voting.
Okay.
Okay, does that blame shift?
I see what you mean.
Hold there as well.
Okay.
Because then,
yes.
Because from my understanding, there's no real whipping system in the parliamentary system there. So you have the distinction between MPs and leadership.
Yes.
It's implicit that it's going to be different. I mean, you understand that. It's an elite focus that, it, of course, it's going to be different. So that you're comparing it in the UK and the British political system, which you're going to have in peace, and then the working system, which will enforce something. So then you have those personality traits of leaders. So if then, during election time,
we see the
then
same.
You do have do you see the same, or is it different? Is the blame game there completely out of it?
No, Vasiliki did some, she ran the same before the elections. We didn't use it at the end. And she was finding the same type of blame shifting happening. Yeah, the same type of pattern. But we thought it was more interesting to look at the debates, focusing at the memoranda, because we wanted to link this to policy implementation at a later stage. If you think of it, the elections were in a very similar period. So it's not surprising that the discourse was quite similar. It's not like the elections happened 2 years later or something. We're talking about months differences. So yeah, the discussion was similar.
Please.
The relationship between the Greek culture in managing economy and blame and blaming as a concept, because if part of the culture, the way we address our economy, let's say corruption, is seen as something that we all participate in, therefore the blaming might be diminished.
No, sorry. So, can you repeat it a bit? I didn't really.
So, if you're looking at if culture itself, you know, people's attitude towards managing the economy, and let's assume that there are corruption, and then part and parcel of that, of the Greek population accept it as something normal, that has an implication in the concept of blaming, or that.
I don't know. I wouldn't be able to say. First of all, I wouldn't see corruption as part of a culture in general. I would say corruption is a phenomenon that needs to be explained, and it's linked to other issues like clientelism and other systemic failures. I don't know if we could link it to blame shifting, really. Definitely this corruption was something that the parliamentarians would always, and in these specific cases, would talk about when they wanted to blame the old establishment. But I don't think this links with the way citizens see corruption necessarily. I mean, openly, citizens would be against corruption, and that's why the new protest parties would really want to like Potami or Golden Dawn, wanted to show that we are breaking from the past, and we are not going to have these patterns, these corrupted patterns of the past, and that's why you should trust us. Yeah. So people, when it comes to thinking in general, they wouldn't be against corruption. Now, if they realize that some of their actions are maybe corrupted, if they call and ask for help from an MP for where they will go for the military service, I don't think that they even realize that maybe this is corruption. Yeah. So the general idea is that corruption is a bad thing, the general concept. So, but then, yeah, I don't know if I'm answering.
Yeah, that's right, because I'm influenced maybe from external media, because that's what I have read. So I'm just posing that question from that standpoint.
Yeah.
Okay, if we come to a conclusion, I guess a system which shifts blame, the people are innocent, the EU is guilty. Thank goodness we don't have any of that here.
No. Maybe an analysis of all the debates in Parliament when the Brexit deal has been voted would be interesting to see.
It would be very interesting to see if there is indeed any pattern.
Yeah.
Any deal. Yes. Okay. Thanks. We've covered a very important aspect of the recent crisis. To remind you, we have the Mayor of Athens coming on the 2nd of April, 6:30, in the Hong Kong Theatre. Athens Grassroots Regeneration, Reflections from Mayor Yorgos Kaminis. So now, thank our speaker, and I'm very grateful for you coming. There is a publication in the Journal of Common Market Studies, which will give the full details. It's obviously ongoing research, so we'll look to see more.
Thank you.
Please join me in thanking Stella
Levin. Thank you.